Okay, so we're going to start by looking at something to do with the Sedra of the Week. Let's just see if we can find it. Right. So here we have the beginning of the Sedra of the Week. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe vel Aharon lemor. God spoke to Moses and Aaron saying, Zot chukat ha-Torah. This is the statute of the Torah. That's the normal way we translate it. This is the statute of the Torah, Asher tziva Hashem lemor, which God commanded, saying, Daber b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, v'yikhu elecha, and let them bring to you fara aduma, a red heifer, a red cow, tmima, which is perfect, asher ein bamum, which does not have any blemishes, asher lo ala aleya ol, on which there's never been a yoke. And it goes on speaking about the whole law of this red cow. And if we just see another sentence or two, when the tatemota el Elazar kohen, you should give it to Elazar the priest, that's the son of Aaron, bohotziota, and he should take it out, el michutz lamachne, outside the camp. So we have the camp of the Israelites in the desert, we have the sanctuary in the middle of the camp, and then we have the Levites camped around the sanctuary, and then we have the four camps of Israelites, north, south, east, west, all around the sanctuary. But here it has to be taken outside the camp, and v'shachat ota lefanav, and then it should be slaughtered, and v'lakach Elazar kohen midama be'etzba'o, Elazar the priest should take some of its blood with his finger, v'hizah, and he should sprinkle it, El nochach pnei oel ma'ed, towards the face, the entrance of the tent of meeting, that means the sanctuary, midama, from its blood, sheva pa'amin, seven times. And then they, having slaughtered the animal, they burn it, and then they throw in a cedar wood and hyssop and crimson wool and throw it into the burning, the fire which is burning. And then v'chibes begadav ha-kohen, the Kohen who's been doing all this, preparing this red heifer, he now has to wash his clothes v'rachatz b'saro b'mayim, and he should wash his body in water. In other words, he has to go to the mikveh. And then he can come to the camp after he's been to the mikveh. And the Kohen is still impure until the evening. So that's the one who prepared it. And similarly, the one who burnt it, also, he becomes impure until the evening. And then, if someone is impure from the dead, the impurity of the dead, there is a special ritual. Let's just see how it works. Hanoger b'met l'chol nefesh adam, someone who touches a corpse, a human corpse, v'tameh shivat yamin, he should be impure for 7 days. And then on the third day and on the seventh day, he is sprinkled with this water from the ashes of this para, from the ashes of this red heifer. And the way in which they prepare it, v'lakchu latameh, they should take for the person who's impure in order to purify him, me'afas reifat ha-chatat, the ashes of this sin offering, in a sense, which has been burnt, this cow, this heifer. They should take its ashes, V'natan alav mayim chayim el keli. And they should put fresh water, living water, into a vessel on top of the ashes, and then they're able to sprinkle it on whatever they are trying to purify, whether it's a person or it might be an object. So that is the law of how the red heifer is utilized. Oh, I'm sorry, there was one thing I wanted to do before we left that text. So I want to go back to the beginning and look in the Rashi, Zot Chukat HaTorah. Now here you can see the Rashi. This is the statute of the Torah. I'm giving the normal translation, not ordinance. And here Rashi says, because Satan and the nations of the world taunt Israel, saying, what is this command and what reason is there for it? On this account, scripture uses the term chukah, a statement, a statute about it, implying it is a statute from me. You have no right to criticize it. So therefore, it is in a special status. We talk about different levels, different types of Jewish laws. There's mishpatim, judgments, which are laws which every nation of the world has, such as not to steal, not to murder, and similar. Then we have ediyot, testimonies, which are laws which we can understand the point of them, like Pesach. It's celebrating going out of Egypt. So we can understand that to celebrate that, we do various things relating back to the time in Egypt. We eat bitter herbs, reminding us of the bitterness. We eat unleavened bread because of the haste with which we left Egypt. We didn't have time to let the dough rise into ordinary bread. But then there are kind of law which are called a chok, a statute. And a statute is something where there is no simple explanation. Now, the discourse is going to say that there are different kinds of statute. Some statutes are more comprehensible than others. And it's generally regarded that this is an incomprehensible a law. It's simply a decree from God, and God has given us this decree, and we have to do it. In fact, however, Rashi does give an interesting rationale. Let's just see if we can find it. Why was this rite performed with a cow? Maybe exemplified by a parable. There's the case of a handmaid's child that defiled the king's palace. It made dirty in the king's palace. They said, let the mother come and wipe up the excrement. Similarly here, since they became defiled by a calf, that's the golden calf, let its mother, a cow, come and atone for the calf. So in that sense, the Midrash Tanchuma, actually does give a kind of rationale for this law. However, the way in which the discourse takes it is that it is beyond any simple rationale. So that's the basic law of the red heifer. And it's about this that we have our discourse. So are there any points that anyone would like to raise at this moment? Everything's clear. So I'm going to play the melody. Oops. Thank you. Oops. Sorry, I don't know why it stopped so abruptly. Okay, I don't know. It seems to stop abruptly. I don't know why. Okay, so let's find the discourse, which is what I've been looking for. And it is here somewhere. Sorry about this. Sorry, just looking. There. Okay, so now I'll share the screen, hopefully. Hi, Eve. Nice seeing you.
I'm nice to see you. I'm glad you're better.
Yes, thank God. Yes, thank you. Thank God. Okay, so here we have the text. Let's see if we can make it a bit bigger. Right, so this is a discourse that was said on Shabbat, Parshat Chukat, which that year, 1965, was on the 10th of Tammuz, as in fact it will be this week as well. And it is a text which was not edited by the Rebbe, it was taught by the Rebbe, and the Rebbe's students and Chozrim, who had this tremendous gift of memory, were able to remember it after Shabbat and write it down word for word, what the Rebbe said. And before being printed, some of these discourses were then edited by the Rebbe, but this one wasn't edited, it's an unedited discourse. Now, Vayedaber Hashem Gomer, God said, now, this is what we just read in the Torah. Zot chukat ha-Torah, this is the statute of the Torah. V'yikhu elecho farah aduma, they should bring to you, to Moses, a red heifer, a red cow. U'mavoa b'likutei Torah. Now, in Likutei Torah, which is the collection of teachings of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lodi, the founder of Chabad, it explains in Yan parah aduma, the concept of this red heifer, Shenem Abba, about which it says, Chukat HaTorah, the statute of the Torah. Now, putting it in this way, the statute of the Torah, is a very interesting way of putting it. It's like putting it at some pedestal. This is the statute of the Torah. And what it explains in Likutei Torah by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, Shezeh Lefi, this is because Shemitzvat para aduma, the command of the red cow, hiklalut haTorah, is the general principle of the Torah. Now that's a very striking statement, right? We all remember the story of someone who asked Hillel, tell me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. And Hillel said, which I'm sure you all remember, what you don't like, don't do to anyone else. That is the whole Torah, the rest is commentary. So here, and there's another place where a similar statement, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, it says in Parshat Kedoshim, you should love your neighbor as yourself. And Rabbi Akiva says, Zeh klal gadol ba-Torah. This is a great principle or the great principle in the Torah. Now here, we're hearing that this red heifer, this mysterious ritual to purify the impure, he klalut ha-Torah is the generality of the Torah. Now, how can it say that? In what way is this the general principle of the Torah? Now, here's a rather mysterious way of looking at it. Let's try and see if we can understand it together. Kiklalud inyana Torah, because the general idea of what the Torah is about and the mitzvah, Usha'al Yedei Zeh, is that through Torah, through mitzvah, through a Jewish lifestyle, Yavo Adam, the person should come, Lebchinat Ratzo Vashov, to a quality of Ratzo Vashov. Now I'd like to pause here for a minute. Ratzo Vashov literally means advance and retreat. And it's particularly like you could apply it to ebb and flow, like the tide which is coming in. And you look at the tide coming in and the waves come in and then they go out again, a bit more in and then more out. And so that movement of forward and back, can I ask you, please, why should that be considered the generality of the Torah, the general principle of the Torah? Why is advance and retreat the general principle of the Torah? Any suggestions?
The ebb and flow of the moon.
Well, you're right, the moon waxes and wanes, but yeah. Why should that be considered the general concept of the Torah?
Because, would it be because nothing is actually static? Everything is in flux. It's moving all the time. Don't know.
I mean, you're right about the moon, you know, but I would be surprised to hear that the movement of the moon is the general principle of the Torah. Eve, did you want to say something?
I was thinking maybe because you can't stay in contact all the time, you have to go and bring back something. You have to, your blessings are, you know, going and bringing back. Like the sons of Aaron, you know, who only wanted to be with Hashem, they died, right?
That's described as going forward without retreat, advance without retreat. That was their problem. Yeah, so in other words, what you're saying is, what I'm extrapolating from what you're saying is, that our relationship with God, which is obviously what the whole Torah is about, our relationship with God is one of advance and retreat. We come close at certain points and then we go back. For example, we pray. Prayer is a beautiful thing. And at the time when a person prays, they're, so to speak, coming close to the divine. But then the prayer ends and one has to get on with one's daily life, one's daily work, whatever it is. Shabbat is a beautiful moment of being, or time, 26 hours, of being close to God. But then come the days of the week and we go on with daily life. If we were close the whole time, as you said about the two sons of Aaron, that doesn't work. It takes us out of life. So it's reaching towards the divine and stepping back towards the world, reaching towards the divine, stepping back towards the world. I think that's a way that we can describe the significance of ebb and flow as something which is really central to the Torah. Because the whole point of the Torah is that as individuals and as the Jewish people as a whole, and ultimately as the world as a whole, we should be connected with God. And in order to be connected with God, there is this ebb and flow process. Now comes the question, how does this relate to the red heifer? Okay, so we've got this point that ebb and flow is the central theme of the Torah. But now, line 7. The inyan zeh baba ve'hu ve'gilui gamur. This idea of ebb and flow is seen very clearly. B'mitzvah para aduma, with the mitzvah of the red heifer. Shekol inyana hu shtei habechinot deratzo v'shuv. The whole idea of this red heifer are these two concepts of ebb and flow. So missing out the brackets. Haratzo, now how do we see the Ratzo, the advance to the divine? Hu inyan schefat ha-para le-efer. The fact that the cow, having been slaughtered, is burnt to ashes. Now, burning is a reaching upwards. The flame burns upwards, and it's as if it's reaching towards the divine. And so the fact that we burn the red heifer is an expression of reaching towards the divine. Bahashov, and the return, the retreat, Hu inyan v'natan alav mayim chayim el keli. It's this verse that we did just read a minute ago. Putting pure living water into the vessel. You put the ashes in the vessel and then you pour water. Now that pouring of water from above downwards is seen as the movement down. So there's the burning is the movement up, and the putting of water in the vessel with the ashes is the movement down. So it's a little bit poetic, if you like. You know, it's taking this ritual, and which is a decree from the divine, and it's seeing in it the burning, which is the reaching upwards, and the flow of water down, which is the return to the lower world. And that's why this is called Chukat HaTorah, the statute of the Torah. So in other words, this mitzvah of the red heifer seems to incorporate in itself the idea of movement up and return below in these two details of the way it's prepared, looked at in this particular way. And the movement up and return below is something central in spiritual life for every human being, connecting with the divine and also keeping one's feet on the ground. So therefore, that's why this is called Chukat HaTorah, the statute of the Torah. Now, the Rebbe compares this. This was a statement by Rabbi Shneur Zalman in his Hasidic teachings. But now the Rebbe asks, Ach tzarich lahavin, but we have to understand. How does this link with the normal explanation? When it says this is the statute of the Torah, it's talking about this mitzvah, this command, which is a statute. It's not something that we understand properly, or maybe that we don't understand at all. It's not understood in ordinary rational terms. Whether we're talking about the idea of bringing purity, the point about the red heifer is that if someone has become impure from the dead, the ashes of the red heifer sprinkled upon the person with water, that takes away that impurity. So, I mean, obviously, purity and impurity is itself a theme which is beyond ordinary rational comprehension. It is, it's not an ordinary rational idea. The idea that if someone is under the same roof as a corpse, that person becomes impure and everything else under that roof could be objects, household objects, whatever it might be. They also become impure from the dead because there's been a corpse under the same roof. And or if a person actually touched the corpse. Now, one of the biggest mitzvot in the whole list of Jewish mitzvot is the preparation of the dead for burial, which is performed by a group of people rightly termed Chevra Kadisha, the sacred company, the sacred group. And there are two groups in every Jewish community, a group of men who prepare, unfortunately, if a man has passed away, they prepare his body for burial. And similarly, a group of women who prepare the body of a woman for burial. No one should, everyone should live, be healthy, But that's the but that is one of the central holy roles in the Jewish community. It's not spoken about a lot, but it's there, and it's a very, very important role. But these people are, of course, they are handling a corpse, so they become impure. So the whole issue of impurity is a fascinating concept. It is a special ritual impurity, which means that the person who's ritually impure cannot do certain things. For example, the most crucial thing is they cannot go into the temple. That's one of the reasons, or the main reason, why when we go to the Kotel in Jerusalem, we do not go past the Kotel onto the higher part of the Temple Mount, or the flat part of the Temple Mount, which lies behind it, because that is a sacred area which we are not allowed to enter if we are ritually impure. And we consider all of us as being ritually impure from the dead, in case we somehow, you know, we walk down Oxford Street and 1,000 years ago, a Viking was buried in what later became Oxford Street. So we walked over his grave and we become impure. And so we didn't know about that. And even if we did know, we went to a cemetery or we're a member of the Chevra Kedisha or we helped carry a coffin to be buried, or we were in a house where unfortunately someone passed away. All this makes us impure, and we do not have the red heifer to purify us. So therefore, the category of being impure from the dead is a significant category. And the question is, how do the ashes of the red heifer mixed with water, why do they have the power to purify us? Like, that's a mystery, you know. So that's the chukah, that's the statute. Now, the other thing, which is puzzling, line 17, it's not only the idea that it purifies people, but maybe you noticed when we were reading the verses about it, shematahehet et atmeim. The impure people who get sprinkled with the ashes of the red heifer, they become pure. Umatamet et hatorim. But if you remember the people preparing the ash, the people who burn the red heifer, they actually become impure. So it's something which makes the pure impure and the impure pure. So that itself is a paradox. Then there's another thing about the making of this, the preparation of this red heifer. Shetzricha liyot chutz l'shalosh machanot. It has to be outside the three camps, outside the camp of what's called the camp of the divine presence, the camp of the Levites, and the camp of Israel. So it's right outside the camp. Hefech kol ha-korbanot, the opposite of all the other offerings, Shemukumam bifnim dafka, which are specifically inside the sacred area of the sanctuary. And as Rashi said, which we looked in Rashi, that the Satan and the nations of the world make fun of the Jewish people. They say, what is this mitzvah for you? What is the reason for it? It's irrational. And so therefore it's a statute, it's a decree before God, which we cannot question. It's simply, we can explore different aspects of it, but it, fundamentally, it's a decree from the divine. And in fact, the Rebbe suggests here that while there are other mitzvot, which are called chukim, which are called statutes, like let's say kashrut. Kashrut is a statute. However, compared with the red heifer, kashrut can be understood, that's how the Rebbe puts it, although compared with not to steal, Okay, not to steal. We understand the basic social contract. People are going to live in a community together. They need rules like not to steal, not to commit adultery. That's a way of keeping basic peace between people. But not to eat animals, certain animals, or to eat them only in a special way. That is a chok, that is a statute, the laws of kashrut. Nonetheless, what the discourse is suggesting is that compared with the red heifer, kashrut can be understood in various ways. We might think of it as, what Samson Raphael Hirsch says about kashrut, that eating certain animals gives the person the character, so to speak, of those animals. And so therefore we are bidden to eat only kosher animals, which for the most part are docile, tame animals, rather than wild animals, whether it's a wolf or a lion or a pig, which isn't wild, but it seems to have qualities which we do not want to imitate. So that's a way of understanding kashrut. Whereas the para aduma, the red heifer, it's something mysterious. And in fact, the sages tell us, now on the next page, shelachein amar Shlomo. That's why King Solomon said, I'll call, this is what the Midrash tells us, I'll call Ela Amadati. I understood everything. But the whole idea of the red heifer, chakati, I examined and I asked and I searched. I said, I will be able to understand it, but in fact, it's distant from me. So that was that's a famous statement by King Solomon, saying that King Solomon was not able to understand this red heifer. But after Moshe Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Midrash or the Talmud tells us that God says to Moses, Lecha ani megale tam para. To you I will reveal the meaning of the red heifer. As the Midrash says, now everything that God was telling Moses about, since there's this idea of pure and impure, at the same time that God told him about the thing, he told him the details of in which way this thing might get impure and in which ways it can be purified. And when they reached to the chapter about the priests themselves, so Moses said to God, Master of the universe, if these priests, you've told me about how important the work of the priests is, they have to work in the sanctuary, they have to offer, bring offerings to God. If they become impure, how can they be purified? And at first, lo heshivo davar, God did not answer him. Otasha, at that moment, nikarkemu panav shel Moshe. Moshe got upset. Right, the Midrash tells us all kinds of fascinating things. So Moshe got upset. However, because God wouldn't tell him how the priests are going to be purified if the priest comes near the dead. Now, a priest is not supposed to come near the dead. But sometimes, if it's, let's say, his own parent, God forbid, then he can, and that would make him impure. And so how can he become purified? And at first, God wouldn't tell him. And Moshe was upset. But then, when they came to Al Sedra, Parshat Paran, Duma, and he learned the law of the red heifer, God said, this is the way the priests can be purified. That you take for the impure person some of the ashes of the burnt cow, and you mix it with water, and you sprinkle it on them. So, rather unexpected response from Moses. Moses said, Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, v'chi taharahi, how can that purify? It's, Moshe himself thinks this is a very strange thing. How on earth is that going to purify them? What's that going to do with purity? You see, we can understand the normal way people get purified. If they're impure, they go to a mikveh. All right. So we can understand, like, impurity is not dirt, but it's some kind of spiritual, it's a spiritual kind of dirt. So when we wash in water, we can remove physical dirt. And when we dip in the mikveh, we submerge ourselves completely in the mikveh, we can somehow empathetically understand that that is a way of spiritually purifying ourselves. The one of the things about the mikveh, tefillah, the word tefillah has the letters habitl, selflessness. By the fact that the person dips in the mikveh and underwater, at that moment, it's as if they're suspending themselves. And that moment of selflessness, that is what brings purity to them. So if you're talking about a mikveh purifying a person, there are various ways we can understand it. Another way is the mikveh is supposed to have 40 measures of water in it. And this is compared with the flood that was 40 days on the earth, the rain falling for 40 days. And that, so to speak, purified the earth of the violence and negativity that had been there before. And so in the same way, there's our kind of private flood. We enter into the mikveh, submerge, which is 40 measures of water, submerge ourselves under the water, and that brings purity. Okay, so there's a sense in which that makes, you know, we can understand that. But just to be, you take a heifer, a cow, slaughter it, sprinkle the blood towards the temple, burn the entire body, take some of the ash, pour water on that ash, and then sprinkle the person with the ash and the water together. Why does that have any effect? So that's what Moshe is asking. So Moshe says, V'chi taharahi, is this really purity? How does this work? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, the Holy One said, Moshe, my dear Moses, Chukai, it is a statute. Ugzeira gazati, I've made a decree. Ve'ein b'riya yecholah lamod al gzeirati. No creature can understand my decree. Dichtiv, as it says, Zot chukat haTorah. This is the statute of the Torah. Don't expect to understand it, says God. So the discourse says, well, this is an interesting thing. This shows how the red heifer is an exceptional law. And so our question is, how does the first statement that we had at the beginning of the discourse, that the red heifer is the general statute of the Torah, and it's the general statute of the Torah because it represents ebb and flow, and the whole Torah is about ebb and flow. That's our relationship with the divine. And then that is one way of understanding the red heifer. And then we have the second way of depicting the red heifer. It's something we can't understand. It's a decree from God. Moses couldn't understand it. King Solomon certainly couldn't understand it. So how do these two explanations fit together? Now, I want to pause at this point and just see whether anyone has any interesting ideas, questions, comments. Anyone?
I think it's kind of intriguing what you said about the heifer turns you from pure to impure and impure to pure. And also all the examples you gave of the mitzvah that make you impure. And I was thinking of the Ketoret, which contains an evil-smelling spice.
Yes, that's a very good point that Eve's making. The ketoret, the incense, which is offered in the temple, it's a very fragrant, it's made of 11 ingredients, and 10 of which are very beautifully fragrant, and one has a bad smell. And that's mixed in together. That's a very interesting juxtaposition of this concept, that there is sort of the negative together with the positive. Yes, I think. And the incense itself is a kind of a mystery. Why does it have this not good smelling ingredient? Yes, that's a very good point. Any other comments from anyone?
It's a question, Rebbe Tally. The were the red heifer at the time, were they were there many?
No. No, what the Talmud says is they were very rare.
Like now?
They were very rare in the time of the temple. They were very rare, and if someone had a red heifer and the sages needed to buy it, they would spend a lot of money buying it. So it was a very rare thing.
So what happened?
It's like a freak. It's like a calf, a female calf is born completely red, and it was it's sort of the equivalent of an albino. You know, sometimes a creature is born completely white. Human beings can also be albinos. You know, they've got very pale skin and white hair. So the same over here with the red heifer. Suddenly there's born a red calf. And whoever has that born in their herd, they look after it very carefully, make sure they don't put a yoke on it, they don't disqualify it in some way. And if the sages want to buy it, then normally the sages would pay a lot of money for it.
If it was that rare, what would happen if they couldn't find one?
Well, the truth is, it's said that there were only 10 such calves or cows from the time of Moses till the time of Mashiach. Mashiach will make the 10th cow. So there were 9 in 3,000 years. They were enough. The burning of the red cow produces a certain quantity of ash, and you only need a tiny little bit of ash to purify a person, and you can purify 100 people all at once. So it was used very, very slowly. That seems to be the case. Okay, let's get back into it now. Hi, Tzipora, nice seeing you. Now, let's...
Nice to see you, Tali. Be well.
Thank you. Now, we're going to look at another dimension of this. This is chapter Bet in the Discourse, which is from 1965. Let's examine what it says in Rabbi Shneur Zalman's teachings, that the word Chukat HaTorah, we've been translating it up to now as statute, Chukat, statute. But it relates to the word Chakika, and Chakika means engraving. The Kae ala Torah kafi shehi b'shosha u'mekora. It's referring to the Torah the way it is in its very source and root. Shesham, and there, he bifchinat otiyot hachakika. The Torah is there in a way of being engraved letters, like the engraved letters on the Ten Commandments, on the two tablets of stone of the Ten Commandments. And you might remember that there is a comment by the sages that the engraving on the two blocks was actually two blocks of sapphire. The two blocks of sapphire, which Moses brought down the mountain, and the Ten Commandments are engraved in Hebrew on those blocks, that the engraving went all the way through the tablets. It wasn't just scratched out on the top. It went all the way through. So the letters went all the way through from one side of the block, the sapphire block, to the other side. So now we're going to explore different ways of writing, because the Torah is written. And so there are different levels of writing. Now, if we say that the red heifer is called chuka, the statue, but also relating to the word chakika, engraving, it relates to the highest level in the way in which the Torah is expressed in the written letters of the written Torah. Like in Gashmiut, in ordinary physical terms, Shabbatiyot Tiva, when you write something, like writing a Torah scroll, you've got ink with dior, and then you've got parchment. So you're writing on the parchment. You're writing words of Torah on the parchment. Now that's a very beautiful thing, and the Torah is an extremely beautiful object. But note, says the discourse, Ha'otiyot hein davar zah v'nifchad me'aklav. The letters are actually something separate from the parchment. You take a quill and you write them on the parchment, but even though it dries there and the writing is there on the parchment, it's something separate. And you know, if the scribe finds he's made a mistake, he takes a kind of a blade, like a shot, like a scalpel, and he rubs on the parchment, and it's quite easy to rub off the black ink which had been written there. And he can rub it off and he can rewrite those words. So the thing is that although the ink is separate to the parchment, when one writes on a parchment background, writing with ink, they become unified at that point that the ink is written on the parchment. But in fact, it begins off two separate things, and although the discourse doesn't mention it, they could be separated again. Whereas otiyot ha-chakika, but letters which are engraved, now there are different kinds of engraving, and the highest kind is like the letters on the luchot, on the tablets of stone or the tablets of sapphire, charut ala luchot, engraved on the tablet. They are not something separate to the tablet. They're actually engraved on the tablet. They are one thing together with the stone or the sapphire on which they're engraved. So we've got two kinds of writing. We've got writing like ink on parchment, where the ink is really something separate to the parchment and it gets written on the parchment. That's very nice and it's unified as a text. But in fact, although the discourse doesn't mention it, it's a little bit fragile. You could quite easily rub off the letters from the parchment. And then we have another kind of writing. We have engraving on stone. And so this engraving, now it explains in a teaching by Rabbi Sholom Dovber, that's the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. He wrote most remarkable discussions of Jewish thought and Hasidic thought. So he explains, he explains that in the idea of engraving letters, there are actually two levels. There's ordinary engraving, chakika stam, and then there's engraving from one side to the other, like the letters on the tablets that Moses brought down Mount Sinai. That it says, there's a verse which says, Mishnei Evreim, on both sides, you could read the words, Mizeh u'mizeh em ktubim. They are written on both sides. And the way the sages understand this is that it's an engraving which goes right through the stone or the base of the tablets. And as we said, the tradition is that they were sapphire. So it's an engraving that went all the way through the sapphire from one side to the other. As the sages said, Mem v'samach shabaluchot b'nes hayu omdim. The letter Mem, the final Mem, which is like a rectangle, and Samoch, which is a circle, they were held there by miracle because if the letters Mem is engraved all the way through, and similarly the letter Samach, then the middle would fall out. Yes, to just putting it in very simple terms. How is the middle of the letter going to be there if the rest of the letter is engraved all the way through? So that's why the sages say Mem and Samach, both those letters, which are the only letters which are a complete rectangle or circle, they were there by miracle. You know, if it's a letter Vav or Chet, you can understand that it's engraved all the way through, and there's another part of the letter which is able to sort of hold it in place. But in the case of Mem, an end of Mem and a Samach, it had to have some miraculous intervention in order that the letter should remain. Now we have two different ways of understanding the letters of engraving. So the difference between these two ways is, first of all, the letters of engraved, the engraved letters in general, which are not from one side to the other, even though they're part of the same stone, let's just think of it in terms of precious stone, and on the precious stone is something is engraved. Now, although the letters are part of the engraving, part of the stone itself, the precious stone, and not like letters of writing, of ink, which is something additional to the parchment. And the letters which are on the parchment actually hide the parchment which is underneath them. It's as if the Rebbe is speaking like based on a certain way of statements of Rabbi Isaac Luria, that the parchment represents something very exalted, the white parchment. And the thing is that the black letters are on the white parchment and they sort of conceal. If the parchment is revealing something very exalted, well, the black letters on the parchment are hiding it. And so the black letters on the parchment are like, as it were, keeping it in this world. Even though the white spaces of the parchment or the white parchment without the black letters is in some sort of more exalted realm. Now, then we have the engravings on the precious stone. Now, the thing is that when you just simply engrave it, not that the letter goes all the way through, but it's an engraving, it's scratched out in the stone. Now, you could fill that groove, it's like made of grooves, let's imagine. You could fill that groove with ink. It might be filled with dust, which would make it obscure. You won't be able to see the letters. Even if it's not dust, it doesn't mention dust in this discourse. It speaks about ink. Even if you talk about ink, so the letters are very clear. They fill the engraving. But although they fill the engraving, they are hiding the stone below, because the stone itself is really the purest thing. And if the letters which are engraved in the precious stone, if those letters are filled, those grooves which make the letters are now, because they're not going all the way through, we're talking about a different kind of letter that doesn't go all the way through. If those grooves are filled with ink, you can see the letters very clearly. You can see what it's saying, but you can't see the stone, the precious stone. And the precious stone has some extraordinary spiritual power which is being concealed. And so in that sense, the letters which are engraved, which do not actually go all the way through, are still a kind of concealment of the essence. Yeah, if we talk about essence and reality, the parchment which is covered with writing, that's certainly a concealment. But even the engraved letters, which are filled with ink, but they are not engraved all the way through, they're also a kind of concealment, until you come to the letters which go all the way through. So the letters which go all the way through, they are they are on a completely different level. Now, then, so that's a kind of a metaphor, an image from the way in which some things are written. Now this metaphor is being applied to the sacred spherot and similar above in spiritual realms. And as it explains there, details of how this relates to spiritual realities above. Now you know that the highest world of the four worlds is emanation. We've got the world of action, the world of formation, the world of creation, and the world of emanation. So it's the most ethereal world. That's why we have this word emanation, and it relates to a very ethereal Hebrew word, atzilut. Now that world of atzilut, of course, it's very sacred. And the nature of the sphirot, of the attributes, the divine attributes, which are in the world of Atzilut, in our metaphor that we've just been talking about, is compared to the letters of which are written on the parchment. Now, this might be a rather striking statement, that the letters on the parchment, which we saw as the lowest level, is here being compared with Atzilut, with the world of emanation, where the sefirot, the divine attributes, the divine emanations in the world of Atzilut, they are very exalted. But the way that the discourse is presenting them, they are like the letters which are the ink letters on parchment. And so although in a sense they reveal, they also conceal. So we have to go to a higher level. And so if we go to a higher level, which is Keter and Adam Kadmon, we go to a higher level of the Sfirot, a much more exalted level. And that is like, but they're still vessels, so to speak, of Sfirot. So that is like the engraving which is engraving on this precious stone, but it doesn't go all the way through. And then we have an even higher level, and that higher level is called Glif Glifu. It's a quote from the Zohar. It's like the very beginning of existence, the very beginning of the Torah, and that engraving in the sort of ultimate unity, that is the way in which that's the very beginning of the whole process of creation and of revelation of the Torah and the mitzvah. And that is like the engraving which goes all the way through. So there we have this idea of these three dimensions of engraving, or of writing. One is that it's ink on parchment. And the other one is that it is engraving, but it doesn't go all the way through. And then finally, the third level, that it goes all the way through. And now we're going to consider how these three dimensions apply to the soul of the individual. But before we do that, let's just stop in case there are any questions that need to be sorted out. So, anyone, any question, any comment? No.
The purpose of the sapphire. What if you know?
The word sapphire in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Relates to the word mesaper, tell, communicate. There's a phrase, the heavens tell the glory of God. And it uses the same root, Hashemayim Mesaprim. The heavens tell the glory of God. So when you look at the heavens, you get an intimation of the glory of God. The sapphire stone, the Ten Commandments, is expressing the Torah in a very profound and beautiful way. So the fact that the two tablets of stone on which the Ten Commandments were made, were engraved, are in fact sapphire tablets, that makes a lot of sense. That's the kind of simple rationale.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are lots of other reasons. But that's a simple way of understanding. Okay, are we all right so far? We haven't fallen out of our seats. It's all straightforward. Okay, let's go back and let's see the next step. Now, section Gimel, let's consider these different kinds of writing the way they are in the soul of a person. And from that, we will understand how that relates, how also the term statue, which means engraving, have an affinity to each other, and that will bring us back to the Red Heifer. So let's see if that's going to work and if we're going to whether or not I'll be able to explain it and whether or not we'll be able to understand it together. Now, we're now looking at a very interesting perspective on the individual. We're looking at ourselves through a kind of Hasidic Kabbalistic lens. And we are all aware of what we consider a very, very important part of ourselves, our mind, our intellect. Now, to what extent is the intellect of a person themselves? Right? And so what it says here is that the intellect of a person, in a sense, it's an addition to the essence of the person. So, for example, there are changes in intellect from youth, a baby, has one level of intellect, and then as he or she gets older, there are other levels of intellect, and as they get older still. So that's all changes which are taking place within the person. So it means that the essence of the person is something else. It means the intellect is not the essence. It's an additional thing. It's very important and so on, but it's not the essence of the person. So in that, it is like the letters which are written on parchment. The intellect of a person are like the letters written on parchment. Then we come to a higher level. That's the letters which are engraved, and that is the essence of the soul, which is higher, infinitely higher, he says, than the intellect, the ordinary intellect. And that's something absolutely beyond. And one second. So the soul is beyond the intellect, and only afterwards the soul is enclosed in the intellect. And it's called the intellectual soul, the nefesh ha-mashkala. And then when we consider the service of the person, that the letters which are engraved in the person's soul, so to speak, is the fact that every individual Jewish man and woman wants by nature to keep the will of God. And this nature is because of the essence of the soul, which is above intellect. So our intellect may have all kinds of, you know, rationalizations and peculiar ways of looking at the world, which don't necessarily accord with the Torah teachings. But the soul has a connection which is far beyond that. And the point is that the way in which we bond with the divine is expressed through the way we keep the mitzvah. And what the discourse is saying, that if we want to go to the deepest level of the soul, and the way in which the soul relates to the divine in a way completely beyond intellect, that takes us to the mitzvah, which are statutes, not the mitzvah we understand. Not the mitzvot which are commemorating things, which we understand them as well, but mitzvot which are really completely beyond understanding. And our deepest level of soul connects to that level beyond understanding. And the reason is because those mitzvot, which are statutes, are beyond intellect, because all the other mitzvot, in some way or other, they fit into the realm of intellect. But here we are connected to God on a level completely beyond that. And that means that at this level beyond, the essence of the soul is able to shine. Remember, part of the whole rationale, which he's describing the different levels of writing and engraving, two levels of engraving. The whole question is, can the precious stone shine, or is it being covered by something? And here we have the idea that it's not covered by anything. And because we've reached this very exalted level of engraving, which goes all the way through, and that's really the statutes of the Torah, like the statute of the red heifer. And so that's why the red heifer is really the statute of the Torah, because it's something that goes beyond all the other laws of the Torah. All the other laws of the Torah in some way connect with sefer, with intellect, or they're limited in this way and that way. But we have this as this bond with the divine on the level of the essence. And that is really our bond with God. And that comes down through us in all the other mitzvah of the Torah. Now that basically communicating the major theme of this discourse. It's a long discourse. It goes on and explores further dimensions. But here we have the question and the answer. The question was, how do these two ways of looking at the whole idea of Zot Chukata Torah, this is the statute of the Torah, how do the two ways of understanding it fit together? On the one hand, the idea that we're talking about something which is the generality of the Torah, it's what Torah is all about. Torah is about ebb and flow, moving towards God and drawing back and consolidating. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is that it's the engraving, so to speak. It's the deep engraving, and it's the point where God and the soul really intimately connect. And the question was asked how these two fit together. And so the answer is because that level of engraving, that level of the statue, which is beyond everything, that is the level which percolates through all the other dimensions of the person's life and his or her relationship with the divine. And that is why that is also the general principle of the Torah in terms of ebb and flow, the way we reach towards the divine. We say the Shema, and then we come out of that, or we say the Amidah, let's say, or there's the Shabbat, there are these moments of closeness to the divine. Then there's our life in the world, being involved in the world. So that runs together with this idea of ebb and flow and of the highest level of the statute of the engraving, which is really an incredible bond with God, which relates to us as each one of us as an individual. So we've tried to put over what I see as, a major theme in this discourse, although there are other themes as well.